I'm going to talk about the forced relocation case in Colombia, but I would try to analyze the consequences of this case, not only for Colombia, but for Latin America, and for people interested in defending the rights of Aboriginal groups, and in general, in cultural minorities. And I would like to mention that in my talk, I will use cultural minorities in a broad way, including both Aboriginal groups and culturally diverse black communities in my country. Well, having said that, I will start my presentation saying that I would like to defend the following three theses in this presentation. The first thesis is that ILO's Convention 169, particularly Article 6, has been fundamental for the protection of cultural minorities' interests in Colombia. And this has been so because of the following two reasons. The first one is that Article 6 expands the kind of groups that are entitled to right to previous consultation. So, not only indigenous groups, but also what Article 6 calls tribal people are entitled to the right to prior or previous consultation. And this has been fundamental in Colombia because the Constitution, the 1991 Constitution, granted the right to prior consultation only to Aboriginal groups. And this idea of tribal peoples, this category, has been fundamental to try to use this right to include culturally diverse Afro-Colombians so that the court and, in general, the Colombian Constitutional Court and, in general, the Colombian state would recognize that these communities are also entitled to the right to prior consultation. And the second reason is that Article 6 of ILO's 169, Convention 169, expands the object regulated by the right to prior consultation. So, as it is usually interpreted, this right is not only used to with regard to development projects. Those projects aim to exploit natural resources within the territories of cultural minorities, but also with regard to legislative and administrative measures. So the object regulated by the prior consultation right is it's bigger. It's in that sense much more powerful, because also in the 1991 Constitution, the Constitution mentions only the right to prior consultation with regard to development projects. So here you have another tool coming from international law in order to protect the rights of cultural minorities in my country, so that all laws and all administrative regulations directly related to the interests of Aboriginal groups and culturally diverse black communities should be consulted with these communities. The second thesis that I would like to defend in this presentation is that the progressive interpretation of Article 6 of Convention 169 is a consequence of the following two reasons. The first one is the alliance between the academy and social organizations that have created an important number of created and well-defined high-impact litigation strategies. One of these strategies ended with the forestry law case decided by the Constitutional Court of Colombia. The second reason is that the Constitutional Court has taken seriously the rights of minority cultures in my country. And it has done this for reasons related to the courts and the Colombian state's legitimacy, as well as to the impact that the international law on that the international discourse on multiculturalism has had in my country, has had in Colombia. And the constitutional doctrine elaborated by the Constitutional Court of Colombia has moved around the following two arguments. The first one is that the right to prior consultation is a fundamental right. And this is very important for Colombia, because this means that citizens, and particular in this case cultural minorities, can use the acción de tutela to defend their rights. And that means that they can use a very simple and fast legal action to protect their rights, in contrast with the traditional, very slow and very complicated legal actions available in the Colombian legal system. The second element that constitutes, that is part of this constitutional doctrine elaborated by the Colombian Constitutional Court, is related to a group of normative criteria that should guide the national government when enforcing the right to prior consultation. And these five criteria are really important because they give precise instructions to the government on how it should enforce the right to prior consultation. And the third thesis that I would like to defend in this presentation is that the multicultural and monist liberal model that justifies the court's interpretation of Convention 169 is more persuasive than the classic liberal model with which it competes. However, it is less convincing than the multicultural and pluralist liberal model that I will offer as an alternative. So as you can see, I will try to talk about three dimensions in my analysis of the Constitutional Court case, Constitutional Court opinion. One is legal, the other one is sociological, and the third one is philosophical. And trying to justify these three arguments, I would like to divide my presentation in two parts. In the first part, I would like to present the basic facts and arguments of the forestry law case, where the court interpreted Convention 169, particularly the right to prior consultation. In this first part, I will also offer and analyze the political and juridical reasons that explain the progressive interpretation of Convention 169 by the Colombian Constitutional Court. In the last section of this first part of my presentation, I would also like to present the spine of the court's doctrine on the right to prior consultation. In the second part of my presentation, I will critically analyze the arguments defended by the classical and multicultural monist liberal models and present the reasons that justify the idea that the multicultural pluralist model, liberal model, offers a better interpretation of the right to prior consultation. So the first part, the forestry law case and basic facts and arguments. The public interest law group at Uniandes, where I work, drafted and filed two lawsuits before the Constitutional Court of Colombia questioning the constitutionality of the general forestry law. The forestry law was drafted by the Ministry of Agriculture and regulated all matters related to the exploitation of forests in Colombia, in my country. The first lawsuit that we drafted and filed using what we called the acción pública de inconstitucionalidad, the literal translation would be the public unconstitutionality action, that is an action that does not need to have a specific individual or group of individuals affected and negatively affected by the law that is questioned. Here, the problem is mainly of the coherence of the legal system. So what we were arguing was that the forestry law was violating the Constitution, not more than that. No, what we're talking about is abstract control of constitutionality. So what we argued in this first lawsuit was that the general forestry law was unconstitutional because it was not consulted with culturally diverse Afro-Colombians and Aboriginal groups, and that this was a government obligation because the law directly affected cultural minorities in my country. And that was the case because you have to take into account that Afro-Colombians and Aboriginal groups are collective owners of around 25% of Colombia's land, and their lands have some of the most important forests in the country. From our point of view, then, the general forestry law violated Article 330 of the Constitution that states that Aboriginal groups have the right to prior consultation, but also we argued that the general forestry law violated Article 6 of ILO's Convention 169. And as I said before, both legal norms include the right to prior or previous consultation. And it is important to note that this first legal lawsuit questioned the constitutionality of the whole general forestry law, not only parts of it. So if the court agreed with us, the court would have declared unconstitutional the whole bill. No? So from a purely strategic point of view, that was very important. While in the second lawsuit, we questioned only some of the constitutionality of some of the articles of the forestry law. We argued that these articles violated the constitutional right to a clean environment and the right to a sustained development. We also used, in the first part, when we made reference to the right to a clean environment, we used international law. In Colombia, the right to a clean environment is a collective right, but in the San Salvador Protocol, it is considered a social and economic and cultural right. Article 11 of the San Salvador Protocol allowed us then to argue that some of the articles of the General Forestry Law were regressive, that pre-existing laws protected the right to a clean environment in a better way than the General Forestry Law. For example, the forestry law allowed lumber companies to build roads in the areas that they were exploiting without asking for a government permit. Also, the forestry law allowed lumber companies to transport wood without a government-issued certification of origin of the wood transported. And this was very grave, very, very serious, because it opened the door for the exploitation of the woods in national parks and national forests. With regard to the right to a sustainable development, this is a constitutional right, we appealed specifically to Article 246. And we interpreted the right to a sustainable development in the following way. On the one hand, we thought that this right tried to balance two competing aims, constitutional aims, and valuable aims. The first one is economic development, and the second one is the protection of the environment. And on the other hand, we thought that the right to a sustainable development, at least in Colombia, should be interpreted as generating certain obligations between generations. So it has a component related to intergenerational solidarity. And we thought that, for example, Article 27 of the General Forestry Law violated the right to a sustainable development. For example, this article allowed human-made forests or man-made forests not funded by the government not to draft environmental management plans. So truly, this was a pro-lumber companies bill that truly allowed very little space for the protection of the environment and for the protection of cultural diversity in my country. Now, those are the basic facts and arguments related to the forestry law case and to the lawsuits filed by the Public Interest Law Group before the Constitutional Court of Colombia. Now, what are the main components of the interpretation that the Constitutional Court articulated or elaborated with regard to a right of prior consultation that is part of ILOS 169 and particularly of its Article 6? From my point of view, what is most important is that the court focused explicitly on the right to prior consultation of legislative and administrative measures directly related to issues that are important for Aboriginal groups or for culturally diverse black communities in my country. And this is important because, at least from what I know, this specific element of the right to prior consultation hasn't been interpreted by other courts. So the contribution of the opinion of the court is truly a contribution to understand ILOS 169, and particularly this Article 6. And in fact, this opinion has been used in Ecuador, has been used in Brazil, has been used in Peru in order to protect the rights of Aboriginal groups and other cultural minorities in these countries. Because all of these countries are part, have ratified ILO's 169. So it has been useful to protect the rights of cultural minorities in other countries in Latin America. So the court said first, with regard to who has the obligation to enforce the right to prior consultation with regard to legislative measures, that it is the national government, the institution that has the obligation to enforce this right. And this is important because, of course, as in many liberal democracies, draft bills can be filed not only by members of Congress, but by the national government and, well, other groups or institutions. So in this case, it's clear that it doesn't matter who files a draft bill, the national government is always obligated to organize a process of consultation with cultural minorities in the country. If it's clear that this draft bill is directly related to interests of cultural minorities. The second element that is important of the court's interpretation of the right to prior consultation is related to the when. When should be this process of consultation organized by the national government? And what the court said was that it should be organized before the draft bill is filed before Congress, so that Aboriginal groups and culturally diverse black communities in my country can truly contribute to the creation of the draft deal and offer their opinions, their informed opinions about the contents of these bills and how, of course, these norms, these legal norms, are going to affect them. The third important element of the court's doctrine that is important from my point of view is related to the how. How should this process of consultation be done? And the court, with regard to this point, offered five criteria. The first one that I think is very important, and I haven't seen it in other opinions of courts of other parts of Latin America, the court said that the process of consultation is a flexible and adaptable process that should take into account the particular characteristics of the cultural minorities involved in that specific case. And the court also said, with regard to this first criterion, that the cultural minorities then should be consulted on how to do and how to organize the process of consultation. No? So it gives power to cultural minorities with regard to how this process should be truly advanced. The second criterion is related to the participation of cultural minorities in this process. And what the court said was that the effective participation of cultural minorities in this process should be directly related to the participation of the representatives that cultural minorities choose. So this is important because what you see in many parts of Latin America is that the national government or the national governments choose who are the ones that they want to talk to. And many times, they want to talk to the people in Aboriginal communities or culturally diverse black communities, to the ones that are inclined to accept the law, the draft bill, or are inclined to accept the development project. So here, the power to choose the representatives of the cultural minorities is within the these cultural minorities. The third criterion, articulated, elaborated by the court, says that cultural minorities should have complete access to information needed to understand and evaluate the draft bill. The fourth one said that parties should recognize themselves as equals and act in good faith during the process. And the fifth criterion says that since cultural minorities do not have veto power, that the right to consultation included in the Colombian Constitution and in Article 6 of ILO's Convention 169 does not include veto power, the final decision made by the government cannot be arbitrary or authoritarian. Now, what are the consequences of a bill, a draft bill, that is not consulted with cultural communities? The court said that first, the law can be declared unconstitutional by the court itself. Second, that the court might say that the law questioned does not obligate cultural minorities. So although it is constitutional, it doesn't apply to cultural minorities. And the court also said that if the law omitted unjustifiably to regulate cultural minority issues, the court can order Congress to regulate these matters. And of course, Congress should consult with cultural minorities the contents of this bill. Now, why has the court interpreted Article 6 of ILO's 169 in a progressive way? Well, from my point of view, there are two groups of reasons. The first group is related to the alliance between social organizations and the academy to protect the rights of cultural minorities in my country. And this alliance has created a strong and well-defined group of litigation strategies that has put some strong political pressure on the court and on other Colombian institutions. And these creative and well-justified legal arguments have moved around two elements. The first one is what we called in many countries in Latin America, not only in Colombia, the constitutional block, el bloque de constitucionalidad. And in the case of Colombia, this constitutional block and the interpretation that the court has created of this category of this legal institution is related to Article 93 in the Constitution. And this article says that all human rights treaties, international human rights treaties, ratified by Colombia are part of the Constitution. So truly what the court said was, when interpreting this constitutional block category, was that the Constitution was not only that document that we usually call the Constitution, but that the Constitution includes also these international human rights treaties. So Colombians have truly more elements to question the actions of the Colombian state and also to question the bills approved by Congress. And this constitutional block, this idea, has been particularly useful because it has allowed to include ILO's 169 within the Colombian legal system, is part of the national system, of the domestic legal system. And this has allowed the court to interpret the Colombian Constitution and the fundamental rights that the Constitution granted Colombians in new and creative ways. The second group of reasons that explain why the court has created this progressive interpretation of Article 6 of ILO's and has been intensely involved in the protection of cultural minorities in Colombia is more related to sociological elements that affect the polity in Colombia. The first reason, the first sociological reason, is related to the court's self-description as the institution in Colombia committed to the protection of fundamental rights. So the court has tried to differentiate itself from other institutions, other Colombian institutions, particularly from Congress, that is seen as a not very efficacious institution and a very corrupt institution. So the court tries to present itself in the polity as the institution that is truly committed to defending the 1991 Constitution and is truly committed to the defense of, to the protection of the basic rights of all Colombians. And of course, this self-description of the court in some cases is a principled argument. Many of the justices that are part of the Constitutional Court in my country truly believe that they have the obligation to protect the fundamental rights of Colombians. But at the same time, this is a strategic argument, because the court has used it to legitimize itself in the polity, to show that it is truly the only Colombian institution that is committed to the common citizen, that is truly the one that is defending the rule of law, that is truly the only institution that might defend what we called the Estado Social de Derecho, the social state of law, that is the pillar of the 1991 Constitution. The second reason that explains, from my point of view, this progressive interpretation of Article 6 of ILO's Convention 169 is how the discourse of the discourse about defending the rights of cultural minorities in my country has been used not only by the court but by the establishment, by the state, to legitimize the establishment and to legitimize the state, in the sense that they can use this discourse to argue that they are truly including voices that have been traditionally marginalized, and that should give elements to common citizens to see the state in a different way, in a different light. A state that is truly committed to the Estado Social de Derecho, that is truly committed to the defense and the protection of the fundamental rights of all citizens. The third reason that explains, from my point of view, why the court has elaborated this progressive interpretation of Article 6 is related to the impact that the international discourse related to cultural minorities and the protection of cultural minorities has had in Colombia. And it is clear that this discourse has been used by powerful international NGOs, by international organizations, and by foreign governments to put pressure on the Colombian government. And this international pressure has truly affected, that has truly influenced some of the Colombians of the Colombian institutions. Clearly, it has influenced the Constitutional Court. And the last reason that I think it explains why the court has created this progressive interpretation of the right to prior consultation is related to the idea that for many constitutional scholars, to protect the rights of cultural minorities and to think about these rights from a theoretical point of view is to be part of what we call in Latin America the legal vanguard, and if you see some of the literature, specialized literature about international, about constitutionalism, you find that the South African court, the Indian court, and the Colombian court are leaders in their areas, leaders in interpreting the constitution, leaders in creating a constitutional doctrine, and for some, these three courts have been fundamental for creating what many authors call a third world constitutionalism. And that an important component, a fundamental pillar of this third world constitutionalism is related to the protection of cultural minority rights. So up to now, the first part of my presentation with the three components that I mentioned before. Now I would like to enter the second part of the presentation related to the models, the political philosophy models that I think can justify in very different ways the right to prior consultation. The first model is what I would like to call pure liberalism or classical liberalism. And from my point of view, this perspective moves around two elements, of course, with regard to the right to prior consultation. The first one is that is related to the way this perspective interprets culture. And what classic liberalism says about culture is that it belongs to the private sphere and not to the public sphere. The public sphere is the orbit of justice, is a sphere where the basic structure of the polity is defined, where the criteria for distributing scarce resources are defined, and where the decisions are made for distributing political and legal power, while the private sphere is the sphere where citizens, individuals in general, choose and transform their life projects. So it is a space where individuals exercise their autonomy, where they create their individual and collective identities. So although culture is important, it is important for individuals, and the state should be neutral towards culture. It shouldn't commit the resources that it controls to promote any of the cultural perspectives that are part of this particular state. The second element that constitutes the view of classic liberalism with regard to the right to prior consultation is related to the connections that classic liberalism makes between this right, the right to prior consultation, and the right to privacy and the right to individual property. So what classic liberalism says is that truly the right to previous consultation is a right to be left alone. It allows people to articulate, to choose, and to transform their life projects. Not more than that. And second, with regard to property, what classic liberalism says is that property is also a function of autonomy, and it's also a function of privacy, because you need property in order to choose your life project, and you need property in order to make real, to materialize your life project, to truly make it not only a theoretical thing, but a material one. So when you have the right to prior consultation, you have a right to protect your property, and you have the right to protect autonomy. And what I find problematic from this interpretation of the right to prior consultation is, on the one hand, that it obscures the collective dimensions of the right to previous consultation. And on the other hand, I would say that it obscures the connections that the right to prior consultation has with self-government rights and with the idea of collective identity, and with also the right to construct, to build, and to transform a collective identity. Because classic liberalism focuses on an individual interpretation of property and on an individual inclined interpretation of the right to privacy. Competing with classic liberalism, you find what I would like to call multicultural and monist liberalism. And I would say that this is a better interpretation of the right to prior consultation. And it is a better interpretation, first, because this perspective understands the right to prior consultation as a fundamental and collective right. So it is not a function of autonomy, and it's not a function of individual property. It is a function of a collectivity or a community that wants to protect and promote their cultural traditions. The second element that constitutes this multicultural and monist liberalism connects the right to prior consultation to self-government rights and to the right to a collective identity. So what is important here is not that the right to prior consultation allows individuals to exercise their autonomy. What is important here is that it allows communities to decide how to deal with their public and private matters. And it also allows them to determine what is the type of relationship that these communities want with the cultural majority and what is the grade of the interaction with this cultural majority that they want, what is the grade that they want to have, the grade of interaction that they want to have with the cultural majority. This multicultural and monist liberal interpretation of the right to prior consultation also recognizes, and this is the third element, the power imbalance between the cultural majority and cultural minority. So it brings into the discussion of the content of the right to prior consultation the principle of equality. And it does recognize that in the field there is truly an imbalance of power between the cultural majority and cultural minorities. And the right to prior consultation is a powerful tool, is a powerful instrument to balance the field. However, I would say that this multicultural and monist liberal perspective of the right to prior consultation, that is the one that I believe is permeating the interpretation that the Constitutional Court made of this right, has an important weakness. And this weakness is related to the idea that cultural minorities do not have veto power, never, as a principle. So at the end, the right to prior consultation is only the right to have an informed discussion with the national government, but not more than that. Of course, that's important. And that allows cultural minorities to present their views about important issues that affect them directly. But at the end, it's the national government or the federal government the one that decides what should be done, if the bill should be approved or if the project, the development project, should be approved too, and the natural resources within Indian territories or within, in the case of Colombia, of culturally diverse black communities should be exploited. So at the end, this multicultural and monist liberalism is committed to the majority rule. At the end, it's saying, well, the interest of the majority is the one that should prevail. And what is also problematic is that it identifies the collective interest, the public interest, with the interest of the majority, obscuring the fact that here what we have, what is involved in the discussion, is the fundamental rights of cultural minorities, and particularly in the case of Colombia and in the case of Latin America, of communities that have been historically discriminated, and communities that have been subordinated by the national government or by the federal government, depending on the state we're talking about, or the country we're talking about. So at the end, this multicultural and monist liberal perspective is committed to a particular interpretation of the state, a view that is truly committed to a centralized and hierarchical political structure that says that only in the margins could cultural minorities express their voice and determine what it should be done with regard to issues directly related to their interests. So truly the space left for cultural diversity by this monist perspective of the state is very small. The third and last model that interprets the right to prior consultation is what I would like to call multicultural and pluralist liberalism. And this view agrees with multicultural and managed pluralism when it says that the right to prior consultation is a fundamental and collective right. It also agrees that the right to prior consultation is strongly connected to self-government rights and to the right to a collective identity. And it also recognizes that the principle of equality is an important part of the whole discussion. However, this multicultural and pluralist liberal perspective, this multicultural and pluralist interpretation of the right to prior consultation, thinks that there should be an exception to the idea that cultural minorities don't have veto power in any case. And this perspective argues that the right to prior consultation includes veto power when the existence of the cultural minority is at risk, when there's evidence, good evidence, powerful evidence that shows that the legislative or administrative measure or the development project is truly going to destroy the cultural community as a particular and distinct community. And of course, this assumes that the cultural community is the one who wants to maintain, to promote, and reproduce their cultural legacies. Of course, this view does not think that culture, and the culture particularly of minorities, should be protected as a principle, only when it should be protected, only when these communities believe that it is valuable to do so. Now, what are the justifications of this interpretation of the right to prior consultation? From my point of view, there are two reasons. The first one is equality. And I would say that it is important to note here that the cultural majority shouldn't be the only community allowed to promote and reproduce its their cultural traditions and their cultural legacy. It is important to note, too, that in order to promote and reproduce a specific cultural legacy or a specific culture, well, you need scarce resources. Some of these scarce resources are economic, but also some of these scarce resources are related to rights. And it's not clear why the only community allowed by the legal system to do so, to reproduce and protect its culture, should be the majority, the culture of the majority, dominant society. Cultural minorities should also have the legal tools and should have the scarce economic resources to do so. And the second reason that justifies this multicultural and pluralist liberalism is compensatory justice. I would say that clearly in Colombia, but also in many other parts of Latin America, Aboriginal groups and culturally diverse black communities have been historically discriminated by the state, have been consciously subordinated by the state. And now that these communities have a specific legal category in order to protect their autonomy, we should generate a different, an alternative interpretation that allows truly these communities to exercise this autonomy. Autonomy that affects not only individuals, but also communities. Because, as I said before, the right to prior consultation is directly related to the right to a collective identity. In sum, then, the right to prior consultation is a powerful tool to protect the rights of cultural minorities. In particular, from my point of view, it is powerful. It is if it is interpreted from the perspective of a multicultural and pluralist liberalism. Thank you very much.